Welcome to Engaging the Issues, West Virginia's only program dedicated to engaging conversations about the issues affecting our families. I am Jeremy Dice, your host and president of the Family Policy Council of West Virginia. As a Christian, trying to apply our worldview in everyday decisions is hard enough. For many, it is even more difficult to connect what we believe as citizens of heaven with our duties as citizens of the United States. Whether it is voting, running for office, or merely praying for our leaders, the idea of a Christian citizenship is an engaging issue. To engage that issue more closely, Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C., joins me on the line. Tony has led the Family Research Council since 2003, and before that, Tony was a Marine, a police officer, a television reporter, and even served in the legislature of his home state of Louisiana. Tony has a tremendous burden to reclaim the culture for Christ and believes that this revival will begin in the churches across America, reach across denominations and racial and economic lines, and build on shared values of family and freedom. Tony, thanks for joining me today on Engaging the Issues.
Well, thank you, Jeremy. Great to be with you. And just let me say thanks for all the work that you do there in West Virginia. And I know sometimes it's challenging at the state level with the Family Policy Council, as I started one in my home state of Louisiana, but they're making a huge impact. In fact, as we look across the country, one of the bright lights is the work that's being done at the state level like you're doing in West Virginia. So thank you.
Well, that's very kind of you, Tony. Our Constitution begins with the words, "We the people." And as Americans, we take great pride in the notion of self-government. So if we are a self-governing people, what does that mean for Christians living in this land?
Well, the founders had a clear understanding that our government didn't work for a people who were not able to self-govern. And you mentioned about Louisiana and my being from there. You know, Louisiana is an interesting case in this. Louisiana was the only state that entered into the Union that had not had experience with self-government as a state. In fact, they had to write about 7 or 8 different constitutions before Congress would accept it to allow them in. They'd been under the French and the Spanish crown, and so they'd had this paternalistic relationship, so they didn't really know how to self-govern. Well, our founders, when they created this country, not only did they look to the colonies and eventually the states that were self-governing, but they looked at the individual, the family, that was able to govern themselves according to the laws of God. And so there was this very clear understanding, as we see in Scripture, the first institution is self-government. Man has to be able to control his own desires, his own ambitions, and that's the only way a republic like ours works.
Well, Christians across denominational lines will admit that the idea of self-government is sometimes a dangerous notion because we're all sinful. We're imperfect people capable of creating a self-interested and self-dealing immoral government as much as a righteous one, perhaps. How ought Christian citizens guard against their own sin nature even as they seek to be faithful American citizens?
Yeah, that's a good question, Jeremy, because, you know, just because we're sinful, and Satan would often use this to say, well, you know, how can you be a part of shaping public policy when you're a sinful individual yourself? Well, it's true, we're all sinners. But it's interesting, we see this in Genesis. We go back to the book of Genesis, and the dispute between Cain and Abel, and God speaks to Cain and says, Cain, sin is at your door, and its desire is to rule over you. The imagery there is that sin is on the outside of our door. The control that we have, that self-government, is to whether we open the door and let it in and dominate our lives or whether we shut the door to it. And so this idea of self-government is that there is a transcendent law of truth that we have to govern ourselves by. As John Adams said, our government is wholly inadequate for the government of any type of people other than a moral and a religious people. And so they expected this self-government to be the foundation of the civil government that they were constructing in this country, and that's why it's lasted for over 230 years.
Well, I got to tell you something that really frustrated me this past election more than just the outcome, and that was that ahead of the election, I had several ministry partners asking us for information about candidates for office. And with our limited budget this year, we did the best that we could to serve them with the information, but it struck me that they were engaging their citizenship a little too late. Mm-hmm. The idea of Christian citizenship means more than just voting every 4 years, yeah. although it means at least that. Mm-hmm. What do you envision for the Christian citizen? What does the ideal Christian citizen look like, and how do they remain engaged beyond the pulling of the political lever every 4 years?
I share in your frustration in that. In part, I lay the responsibility of that to the conditioning of groups like ours to some extent that have come before us that only engage the church at election time. So we become conditioned that the only time we exercise our citizenship is at election time. And let me tell you, one way we overcome that, and as we at Family Research Council, since I arrived almost 10 years ago, I've been working aggressively with pastors and churches across the country, because, and the reason for that is not political, the reason for that is spiritual. The issues, while we wrestle here in the political realm, we understand that America is not suffering from a political problem. It's suffering from a spiritual problem. Now, that doesn't mean we neglect the political realm, but we've got to address the deeper spiritual issues, and we've got to have the spiritual leadership to do that. But as that plays itself out in the political world, and we use the word political, and that often has negative connotations to it, but I prefer to talk about our Christian citizenship of engagement that requires engagement, calls for engagement. We challenge churches to do a Christian citizenship day every year, and in as a part of that, do voter registration every year, regardless if there's an election or not. We shouldn't just be thinking about our citizenship responsibilities when there's an election. We should be thinking constantly about our call to be salt, to be light, to be engaged in the process. And elections, that's only a part of that responsibility.
Tony, you've done something that I think many Christian socio-political leaders like you have avoided for years. And namely, you've engaged the discussion of these important social issues in venues that are often hostile to your own message. I'm thinking of appearances in which I've seen you on MSNBC and CNN and other networks where you are not just the token conservative, but really the philosophical target of those that are debating you. Yet you not only stand your ground, but maintain a very winsome presence in the media. Perhaps your Marine training suggests that you always act strategically. So what led you to engage these discussions, and why do you continue them in what some might term as, well, hostile territory?
Well, you know, you mentioned my Marine background, Jeremy, and as a Marine, you may have a different specialty. I was an anti-tank. You could be a clerk. You could be a cook. You could be a truck driver, but When it all came down to, everyone was a rifleman. So that was your basic job, no matter what your other job was. Well, as a Christian, you know, my job has been, I've been a reporter, as you mentioned. I've been in the legislature. I've done these different things. But as a Christian, all of us, no matter what we do, an accountant, a banker, a pastor, a teacher, when it comes down to it, we're all evangelists. We're all called to go forth and to make disciples. And so the reason we should be willing to go into these hostile territories is to take truth for the purpose of people coming to know that truth. And we have to speak out of a redemptive heart. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, we speak the truth, but we speak it in love. We speak the hard truth, things that people don't want to hear. But the heart that we have, that we speak from, really conditions the tone of our words. If we're wanting to win an argument, then we're going to come across probably as maybe harsh. But if our goal is really to see people to come to know the truth so that they might have life and have it more abundantly, then, you know, we're going to be able to take, you know, being the target occasionally. And I find that actually, Jeremy, is to be kind of a, I'm pretty competitive. I like to go into those settings and win, not by dominating the debate, but by coming away and the people on the other side saying, you know what, I might not agree with you, but you're pretty reasonable about that, and I need to think about that. And that's where we score points.
Those Christians who engage the political discussion are often mocked by our opponents, and they're called names. Many, they're really too vulgar to even mention on the air. Some would give up in the face of such harassment. So, well, why don't you?
Well, it's because that's what the Lord's called me to do. I mean, I don't like conflict. People would be shocked for me to say that, but I'm one that if we go out to eat, my wife and I, and something's not right about the order, I just soon eat it and not say anything. You know, I have to let my wife do that because I just don't like conflict. I never have. But when there's truth that's not mine, I'm not speaking for myself. Let me give you a good example of this. Let me to talk. From a theoretical standpoint, let me talk from a very practical standpoint. One of the things that some hosts like to do is trap Christians into this talking about, you really think there's only one way to heaven, one way of salvation. And I've seen some very prominent Christian leaders kind of begin to say, well, you know, I don't know. You know, you can be good. You can find there's many ways. And look, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. I didn't say that. Some preacher didn't say that. Jesus himself said that. That's truth. And so if I'm going to follow him and be faithful to him, then I need to be willing to stand up and say, yes, Jesus said that, and I'm not going to back away from it. So it's the same thing with marriage. It's the same thing with life. It's the same thing with every biblical principle that we uncover and that we are taught. We need to be willing to stand and speak. It's not our words. It's God's words. And so we have no reason to be apologetic for that and back away from it. We need to stand firm upon it and speak that truth in love.
One of the things that I have appreciated most about your leadership at the Family Research Council is that you have demonstrated a real passion for engaging the church in these political fights. You mentioned that a moment ago. Help our listeners, many of whom are pastors themselves, understand your motivation for mobilizing the church, making them engaged in this political and cultural fight, I suppose, and how they might also link arms with you and the Family Research Council.
Well, Jeremy, it's really a question of the church. As I mentioned earlier, that we're not in a political battle. We're in a spiritual battle. We need the spiritual leaders of our nation to be engaged. I was born into an unchurched home. It was age of five, a small church at a vacation Bible school, and I wanted to go, and I went. As a result, I kept pleading with my parents to take me back to church because I had a good time. And as a result of that, my father and my mother came to know the Lord, and eventually my entire family and extended family. A small church, local pastor, congregation never got over 200. But that has had a tremendous impact on my life as I've now grown up in the church. And I want people to come to know the fullness of life through a relationship with Jesus Christ. And I see the culture that is becoming increasingly hostile to that message. In fact, we've seen it over the last 40 to 50 years how that message is being excluded from the public square, school prayer, Bible reading, and under this administration, the last 4 years has accelerated rapidly to where we cannot even practice our faith in public in many areas. And so if we're going to preserve the ability to carry out the Great Commission freely without persecution in this country, the church has to exercise its freedoms of speech, freedoms of religion, to preserve those first freedoms that the founders called. And so that's my rationale. That's my reason. It's not just to win political battles and debates. It's the ability to preserve our opportunity, our right to spread the gospel in this country and beyond.
Well, before I let you go, I want to give our listeners a little insight into the Family Research Council and who you are and what you do in Washington. So first, give us your elevator pitch. What is the who, what, and why of the Family Research Council?
Well, we are now moving into our 30th year here in Washington, D.C., and in a nutshell, Jeremy, what we do is we work to shape public policy as it pertains to families from a Christian perspective. We're unapologetically Christian. I'm six blocks from the Capitol, about eight blocks from the White House, and we have a staff of about 80 people, and we have been planted here in Washington, D.C. to speak the truth and to work with policymakers, shaping policy, crafting policy, engaging the media on the debate over these issues. We're the voice of Christian families across this country here at the seat of government in Washington, D.C.
What are one or two of the most important projects that you and the Family Research Council are currently working on, not just behind the scenes, but specifically with our elected officials? What should we be paying attention to?
Well, I remain increasingly concerned about religious liberty and the threat to religious freedom we see in this country. We see a lot of conversation from this administration, even this Congress, about, yes, they agree we have the freedom of worship. The big difference, Jeremy, between the freedom of worship, and you know this as an attorney, and what we're guaranteed under our Constitution, the freedom of religion. The freedom of religion is what we see being attacked today. For instance, with the Hobby Lobby, who is being mandated by the federal government to provide to their employees, a Christian-owned company, privately owned, being forced to provide abortion-inducing drugs to their employees. And because they're not, they've refused to comply, they're paying $1.3 million a day in fines. As a Christian, as an American, you have the right, the first freedom, the right to religious freedom. That means you have the ability to live your life according to the teachings of your faith, not the freedom of worship, which is the ability to maybe go into a building between 11 and 12 on Sundays. No, the founders' vision extended far beyond that so that we could have a country of people governed by their faith, making it easier to maintain smaller, efficient government because people govern themselves.
Washington, D.C. seems to have no end to the political drama. Our year in 2012 ended almost like it began on the same issue, and we're still feeling the effects of rising deficits and that sort of thing, and no one seems to be having a specific solution for anything. So as Christians, what should Christian citizens be watching for in Washington, and how should they be working, and not just praying, but also that, for this new Congress in the months to come as this year begins?
Well, this should be a real wake-up call. We had this, you know, fiscal cliff debate at the end of the year. Now we're looking at a debt ceiling debate coming up within the next 4 to 6 weeks as we've bumped up to $16.4 trillion in debt. First, I think we, as we put our voice into this debate over raising the debt ceiling and the fact that we need to get our spending under control and have more accountability and end this fiscal irresponsibility that's been going on in this city. As Christians, we need to stop just a moment and make sure we're operating according to sound biblical fiscal principles. The Bible has a lot to say to these issues. And a part of the problem we're facing in America, not only is government out of control, living beyond its means, but so are many Americans. And we need to have our own fiscal house in order first. So there's a personal component to each of these issues. And then secondly, as we apply those biblical principles to ourselves and to our families, then we need to be working out, reaching out, going beyond, and petitioning our government to operate under those same principles of accountability and responsibility. And so this debate is going to be on us very soon, on the debt ceiling, and then followed by what's called a continuing resolution, which is the budgeting mechanism they're using now. They haven't passed a budget out of the Senate in over 3 years, so they're just continuing to add money to the existing budget every year. We need to have a serious conversation as a nation about our financial priorities.
Well, Tony, thank you, and I'm grateful for the uncompromising leadership you provide in D.C. and the gracious manner in which you present that leadership. And thanks also for joining me today on Engaging the Issues.
Well, thank you, Jeremy. I always appreciate the opportunity to work with our leaders at the state level, and I encourage you to continue holding up that flag of truth right there in West Virginia.
Well, it's a little hard to summarize all that Tony has talked about today. Our conversation ranged over a variety of issues, but central to it all is the idea of Christian citizenship. His point is clear. Christians have a duty to be involved in self-government, to be involved Christianly, and that involvement starts at home. That's where any political discussion ought to begin, at the home. Far too often, politicians practice trickle-down self-government, hoping that more legislation, more government, and more bureaucracy will somehow trickle down to make individuals more responsible for themselves and for their society. Well, not only does that not work, but it leads to much of what we are seeing today, namely, government acting like a parent trying to control their unruly child. That's not self-government. Self-government depends upon individuals first governing themselves. That is, for government to work and to work well, we must first recognize that we have a duty to align ourselves under a moral order. It is difficult to regulate crime, for instance, if we are all criminals. Our economy cannot be well ordered if every economic actor insists on greed as the chief virtue. Justice cannot be obtained if every citizen is a liar. The point is that self-government means self-regulation. So, as we begin to criticize government, we ought to first evaluate how we regulate ourselves and whether or not we submit to a moral order. At the same time, government cannot fill the void its citizens leave behind. It is unjust for a government to do more than it has been given the limited authority to so do. And there, the popular idea of self-government does help. When citizens elect a government, their job is not over. Self-government suggests that not only do we elect lawmakers to do the work of government, but we have an ongoing obligation to hold them accountable not only to their word, but to their very purpose. You see, a Christian view of government says that government itself is limited. It is not the solution for every problem, nor even for most problems. Its primary function is to punish evil and preserve the space for the gospel to go forward. Yet today, many have been conditioned into holding our government accountable only every election cycle. But that misunderstands the idea of Christian citizenship and permits a government to exceed its own bounds. The faithful Christian citizen will vote at the appropriate time, but will follow his vote with his voice, urging those elected to listen as they represent him in government. And that is where we have a great opportunity to insert the gospel into this discussion. Many, if not most, political discussions turn on important ideas of right and wrong. Christian citizens involved in those discussions, then, have the opportunity to speak the truth and to speak it graciously with, as Tony reminded us, a redemptive heart. Well, that gets at one of the driving convictions of who we are at the Family Policy Council of West Virginia. We believe that Christ came, as it says in John 1:14, full of grace and truth. And as followers of Christ, then, we are to imitate our great Savior in every respect. Just as we must speak the truth on the important issues of our day, truths that are by their very nature countercultural, we are called to speak that truth in a very gracious manner. Christ is our model here. He is 100% truth and 100% grace at all times. Christ has never been absent of one or the other, but is complete in both at all times. His gospel reveals the truth of our sinful condition, but offers the great hope that he has achieved our salvation by his life and by his death on the cross. So let us not grow weary as Christian citizens of this country. Let us be faithful citizens, men and women who understand the truth, can articulate that truth, and then present that truth graciously out of a heart that seeks the redemption of sinners so that they will be citizens of a heavenly kingdom as well. Thanks for listening. Learn more about Tony Perkins and his new daily radio program at tonyperkins.com. Engaging the Issues is supported by the faith-based giving of families like yours. We welcome your financial partnership at familypolicywv.com, where you can also learn more about how the Family Policy Council of West Virginia is advancing, defending, and equipping West Virginia's families through policy, politics, and preparation. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/FPCWV, and be sure to visit our blog at engagefamilyminute.com to learn how you can engage the issues as well.